BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. NATO's secret powwow with royalty, big business, bankers and politicians has passed off with barely a whisper in the British media once again. We discuss some of the revelations from this year's NATO conference, the secret government, which took place in Switzerland last weekend. And also now, Adam Curtis's TV series, All Looked Over by Machines of Loving Grace, is over. Let's have a look at Ayn Rand. Plus, another sneak preview of Unlawful Killing. That's Keith Allen's film about the death of Princess Diana, which is being watched by audiences right round the world, but is banned here in Britain. But before all that, though, we have a meeting coming up this week at the Colston Hall. We talked about the conference taking place tomorrow, which is organised by Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. But this is taking place a little bit later in the week, isn't it, Martin?
What's taking place later in the week? Oh, yes. This is another event at the Colston Hall on the 21st of June. That's a Tuesday. It's going to be a presentation by Richard Gage, AIA, which he's a top architect from the United States of America, from Los Angeles. He's formed an organisation called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And I've seen him speak at the engineering department at London University. And he explains, for a general audience, but with quite a technical explanation, what he thinks happened on 9/11, and of course it doesn't actually tally with what we've been told all these years. Basically, he will argue that the buildings were destroyed by controlled demolition. The three buildings which were destroyed on 9/11 were destroyed by controlled demolition.
So is Richard a conspiracy theorist?
No, he's an architect, and he's actually a Bush voter. One of the first things he says when he starts his presentation is he shows various skyscrapers that he's built, and he said, until recently I was a Republican voter and I voted for Bush, but I'm an architect and I'm afraid the government story just won't hold water.
So what's the main premise of what he's saying then? I mean, you talked about three buildings. The Twin Towers came down.
Well, yes, most people know about the Twin Towers, but a third building, WTC7, also came down at 5:20 in the afternoon. The two buildings came down in the morning at about 10 o'clock in the morning, between 10 and 11 o'clock. This building collapsed several hours later. And if people have got a computer, they can just put it into their search engine, WTC7, and you will see video footage, lots of video footage of the third building collapsing, which no plane crashed into. Now, the government story is that the first two buildings collapsed because jet fuel caused fires, which caused a pancake collapse of the floors. WTC7 collapsed in exactly the same way as the other two buildings, except no aircraft, no fires. How come? And basically, if you want to know more, you should come along to the event or look up the website ae911truth.org, where all of the information is there. 1,000 architects and engineers, more than 1,000 now, have signed up to say that they're not happy with the government's tale about this and that they want a further investigation.
Now, Richard Gage is coming here to Bristol. Is it Tuesday evening, you said, is it?
Yes, he's going to be at the Royal Institute of British Architects on Monday evening in London. He's also going to be in other places around the country.
But why is it that, I mean, this is architects, but are there any other groups of people who are reinvestigation?
Yeah, there's a sister organisation called Military Officers for 9/11 Truth. If you just put that into a search engine, that will come up. And that's got over 250 senior US military officers who are saying this story doesn't add up. And they've got Air Force people there, they've got intelligence people, they've got ex-US Marines people. I'm afraid the government's story is being seriously questioned by serious people.
So what he's basically saying is that the planes flying into the Twin Towers didn't cause them to collapse. Is that what he's saying?
Basically, yes.
So what did?
controlled demolition. In other words, all three buildings were bombed internally, and as he will point out, it's been peer-reviewed in chemistry journals all over the world. Dr. Nils Harriet of Copenhagen University and Steve Jones from the University of Utah have proved that in the rubble of the World Trade Center was nanothermite. Nanothermite is a top explosive, a very, very high-level explosive, and the only people who've actually got any of this are the US government.
Now, so what's the motive here? Because if Osama bin Laden would have found it quite difficult, I imagine, to get all these explosives into the Twin Towers. So what's the motive behind someone going in beforehand to put loads of explosives in there, if that's true?
Well, basically, Richard Gage will not talk about motives. He's an architect, and he will talk about what he knows about, which is the technical details of how these buildings are built. And of course, these buildings are designed to take aeroplane hits. They were always designed to take aeroplane hits. The skyscrapers have always been designed with that in mind. I will tell you what the motive is, but he won't discuss the motive. The motive is because most ordinary people would not want to go to war to steal other people's resources, oil, what have you. They're nice people. They wouldn't want to do something like that. So you've got to make them feel they're under attack if you want to invade places like Iraq. That's basically the motive. It's not that difficult to understand. Most poor people in the world have seen through this a long time ago. I was handing out leaflets about this at mosques in Bristol, and most people are very well aware of what's been going on and what the motives are. It's a very, very sad knowledge that people have about this. What I would say as a British person is it's insults to our war dead in two world wars, all the struggle, all the sacrifice, so that these people could do some stupid trick like this all over again. But I'm afraid that's where we are, folks. As the 10th anniversary approaches, we intend to make this stick, because we're not going to put up with it.
Can you just remind us where and when it's taking place again?
Yes, it's on the 21st of June, Tuesday the 21st of June. That's next Tuesday at Colston Hall in the centre of Bristol. I'm afraid there is a fee to come in because we've got to pay aeroplane fares. We're not funded by hedge funds or by the government, but it's only £4 if you're on unwaged and £6 if you're waged. If you are going to come and you're listening to this, do turn up early because we're expecting a very big crowd.
Now, Martin, you've been involved in organising this. Why? Why is it something you think so important?
It's probably the most important event of our time. On the day it happened, I was suspicious, and I immediately started investigating aspects of it. One of the first things I uncovered within the first week, for example, is that the deputy director of the FBI, John O'Neill, had resigned from the FBI in July 2001 and gave a press conference in France saying the government is protecting bin Laden. My job is to catch him, but every time I get near him, I'm told to lay off. That's why I've resigned. So I'm not a technical person, although I can see that these buildings, to my eye, they look as if they've been bombed. But Richard Gage proved to the satisfaction of the University of London Engineering Department a couple of years ago that they were indeed bombed. And he will explain why if you turn up on the event, to the event, or look him up on the internet, ae411truth.org. You've got it there, Tony. What is the website?
Yes, it's www.ae911truth.org. And the event is Tuesday, next Tuesday, 7:30 at Colston Hall. Tickets are £6 or £4.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now to that old chestnut, Fukushima. Remember the tsunami, the earthquake, and the radioactive meltdown? Well, we were told originally it wasn't a meltdown of the radioactive plant, but in fact it's turned out it was. And in fact, some of the photographs on the internet, you can actually even see rather sinister kind of glowing lump down inside these reactors, which was filmed just the week of that accident. But we hear this week from Russia Today, in fact it's one of their reporters called I don't have the guy's name. I should have, but I don't. That the strontium levels within about 40 miles of the Fukushima plant in a place called Fukushima City are up to 1,000 times over the maximum safe limit, and the Japanese government is now considering actually increasing the exclusion zone, that people may well have to move out of Fukushima City. And we haven't heard much about this in the British press, and this has been on the channel Russia Today.
if you look at a map of where Fukushima City is in relation to the actual nuclear facility, that's plant number one, where a lot of that radiation is emanating from, the winds are bringing that radiation in to Fukushima City, and the rain and the wind is blowing the radiation this direction. So we were at a spot where the radiation levels were 1,000 times what is considered to be a safe dosage. So very, very dangerous levels. You can actually have one spot which it's only 30 times the accepted normal levels, and then you go to another spot which is just a meter away, and it can jump to 500 to 1,000 times, depending on where rainwater and mud have collected.
Yes, so wildly varying radiation levels in Fukushima City, but 1,000 times over the maximum safe limit, Martin. This is a bit worrying, isn't it?
Well, as I said earlier, I'm not really a technical person, but it's quite clear that the government in Japan have been telling fibs, to put no finer point on it. They initially said there was nothing to worry about. I think that's probably a bit of a reflex reaction in Japan. They don't like to panic people. But their people don't panic. I mean, the tsunami, if you look at the Japanese, they handled that incredibly well. I was really amazed and impressed by the way they handled, the people handled what happened there. If that happened in Britain, we would be in chaos. But the Japanese just responded with fantastic kind of nerve and commitment. But nevertheless, they have a tendency to try and hide the truth. And the truth is that these three nuclear reactors have melted down and are still melting down. The consequences are three Chernobyls, but that are still going on. And you know, if I lived in that part of the world, I'd be seriously worried about it.
The problem with radioactive strontium, which has been found in the water all around that area now, is that the fish and actually any living creatures mistake it for calcium. And what they use is they use it to actually build their bones with radioactive strontium. And it then goes up through the food chain. So yeah. I wonder if maybe in the months years to come, whether there actually is going to be quite a lot of radioactive fish products coming from, and of course the Japanese love their fish.
Indeed. So just think how appalling this situation is. Where I've read reports which are admittedly alarmist, suggesting that the whole Tokyo area may have to be evacuated. And that, of course, is really bad for the world economy, which is something I do know something about. The Japanese economy fell by a year-on-year 3% in the last quarter. Now, they're the second or third biggest economy in the world, and if they're going to fall down a hole as a result of what's happened with the tsunami, the earthquake and Fukushima, we're all going down that hole with them. And that's before we think about the Greek default, before we think about the Irish default, whatever. I mean, there's so many things which could tip the world economy into a major, not recession, but depression, or possibly a hyperinflationary depression, which we've never seen before. So you could have a situation in the US like in the collapse of the Soviet Union, where prices are going through the roof at the same time as everybody's being thrown out of work, which will be absolutely horrendous. And don't forget, unlike the Soviet Union, most people in the US are armed, so that you can have all sorts of consequences.
Hyperinflationary, what was that?
A hyperinflationary depression. I mean, in the 30s, in Germany, they went through two phases. One was the inflationary phase, where basically money became worthless and people lost their savings. Then in the 1929 collapse on Wall Street led to a deflationary phase, where prices were falling and people had no money. But at least prices were falling, so people were being put out of work. They were spending their savings just to feed themselves. It was pretty bad. But of course, what could happen in the US in particular is a hyperinflationary depression. So the dollar is becoming toilet paper at the same time as you have lost your job and you've got no source of income. And of course, as I said earlier, everybody's armed. So you think of the consequences of that. If you can't feed your kids and you've got an automatic rifle, what do you do?
Now, one of the famous cases, as I understand it, of hyperinflation was took place in Germany before Hitler came to power.
That's right.
So do you think there may be a danger, if we have hyperinflation, of something similar happening?
Well,
a kind of rise of fascism?
We've just been talking about 9/11 as a potential inside job by the US government. Maybe we're already in fascism. Maybe it's already happened, but we just haven't noticed. Meanwhile, the economy is going down the tubes big style. Wars are breaking out all over the planet. It's not a happy moment.
But is that what you think may happen here, that money becomes worthless very quickly?
Well,
we get £1,000 notes, this
well,
kind of
I mean,
thing?
The dollar is...
Or is it likely to be more like sort of the cash points?
No, we will probably have just the cash points, not handing over the money. In the US, because there's so many dollars been printed over the years to fight all these wars from Vietnam onwards, if once people dump the dollar, all those dollars come rushing back into the United States, forcing up prices for the people who live there. So they've got a particular problem to deal with. Everybody else has had to have have some restraint on printing money because they just can't do what they do. But if all of the dollars in the world come shooting back to the United States in one go, they will get hyperinflation. When we're talking hundreds of percent of inflation, which will wipe out everything, people's savings and so on. But usually when that happens, as it did in the 30s in Germany, you keep your job. Yeah, you keep your job even though the prices are going up. But you could have a situation where the prices are going up and you lose your job simultaneously. So it's like a complete stroke plus heart attack, which is absolutely terrifying. We've never seen that before. That will be, well, we have seen it before in the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was pretty grim then.
Any lessons to learn from that time?
The basic lesson is don't presume we know what's going on. Be very careful. Have a plan B, have a plan C, have a plan D. I believe that the civil services of the world should have a plan B for a banking collapse, because it's almost certainly going to happen. And some of them say, well, there isn't going to be a banking collapse because we're going to stop it. So try and stop it by all means, but you've got to have a plan B if it does happen. And of course that means actually some big changes in the way we organise things.
Now, this is recycling a couple of weeks to The Guardian, Deborah Orr. Maybe we should have brought this article up before, but this is one in The Guardian. It says, the headline is, "Forget entrepreneurs, only banks can create wealth." She says, "We must hope the banks can become less sick and less mad and realise that to save themselves, they must save everyone. Entrepreneurs," she says, "it has been said so many times over the last 30 years, create wealth. Right this minute, the foolish government is sitting around waiting with bated breath for glamorous entrepreneurs." I suppose this is the Alan Sugars of this world.
Janet Street Porter.
To get on with doing just that. But there are no signs that a great boom in business ingenuity is on its way. So why are entrepreneurs being so shy? Don't they want to create wealth? They probably do. But the fact is this. The entire entrepreneurs create wealth thing is a fallacy, and the government is wrong to place its faith in it. Entrepreneurs don't create wealth. Banks create wealth. Only banks. And if you wonder why politicians seem so powerless to rein them in, then wonder no more. It is for this simple reason. Banks have a monopoly on wealth creation. Now, do you think she's making some useful, important points? Because I found that quite an interesting take.
Yes, but she's also being ironic, of course. It is entrepreneurs that create wealth ultimately. But of course, no entrepreneur is going to put their head over the parapet in the biggest hyperinflationary depression in history. You'd be a fool if you did, wouldn't you?
So what are you saying is that entrepreneurs are a lot unlikely to be around right now because that is a risky business and the banks don't want to take risks.
Well, no, the banks, what's happened is the banks, under a free market regime, when the banks couldn't pay their debts, they should have been allowed to go bust. Now, we didn't do that. All over the world, the banks were rescued by the politicians, by the taxpayer. But at that point, you've really got to rein them in. And of course, the problem is that by rescuing the banks, you give them a load more money. And what they do with that money is they then buy more politicians, which is what they've been doing for ages. So we can't have a serious discussion about what we're going to do post-private banking, because that discussion has been closed off. So we're giving money to the banks. The banks use that money then to buy the politicians. The politicians do what the banks want. Now, what is the definition of fascism? I don't know, but we're getting pretty close to it. It's an oligarchy that's running the country. Military-industrial complex and the financial oligarchy, and the rest of us are just tenantry, disposable. They don't care whether we live or die, and that's going to become increasingly clear to people.
Banks have a monopoly on wealth creation. So what does that mean for us right now? Because the banks, there is no monopoly with the banks. Some of them are publicly owned, some are privately owned.
No, the banks actually create the money supply. This is one of the problems. If the government created the money supply, we'd be in a different situation. But essentially, the creation of the money supply has been subcontracted to private contractors. Now, they, of course, have got their own interests, which are not the interests of society at large. And there's a lot of people talking about, including Mervyn King, the head of the Bank of England, saying it's time we had a look at this system, because it's got to stay. You know, we should get to a system where the money supply is in fact created by the government and controlled by the government. But then, of course, if you're going to have government-controlled money supply, or a nationalised central bank, if you like, the question then becomes, whose government? Who's going to control that? Is it going to be a government like the government of King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, or is it going to be a government like that of Nick Clegg? The question then becomes, how democratic is your government if you're going to have a government-run system? But we're not even talking about having a government-run system yet. We will be, because by the end of the year, I fear that the banks will have collapsed. And then you can hit them as hard as you like, but a dead donkey is a dead donkey, and it's not going to get up.
Isn't a government-run system just as open to corruption as a private one?
It's potentially open to corruption, as all systems are, but that's why we invented democracy, to try and keep governments under control. Not that we're actually succeeding at the moment, but I mean, that's the principle.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Well, on to our weekly, as it's been the last few weeks. We didn't do it last week because we had lots of coverage of the Bilderberg conference over in Switzerland. A sneak preview of Unlawful Killing, that is Keith Allen's film about the death of Princess Diana. And the thing that's frustrating me is it's being watched all around the world, except here in Britain. So here's another sneak preview this week.
What if this woman's name had been Diana Smith, and she'd written in a note which had been subsequently unveiled, "My husband Charles Smith wants me to die in a car accident," and subsequently she did. In any other family or in any other country, surely Charles Smith would have been called to the witness stand at the inquest into his wife's death.
When you have the head of the British Security Services calmly announcing we have never killed anybody in the last 50 years, I laughed out loud. What's the point of them then? Now, we've all been to James Bond movies, thanks. We know the security services do a lot of dark stuff. So the idea that we're supposed to believe that in 50 years the British secret agents have never actually killed anyone, I didn't believe it. And so if you don't believe that, where does that leave the rest of the establishment evidence?
Who knows what fate will produce? Who knows what circumstances will provoke?
It's weird that at a time when you know the establishment can think of nothing worse than Dodi Fayed, son of Muhammad, marrying, possibly impregnating Diana, that she's conducting a major international offensive against landmines with all the crippling economic problems that would bring for the British establishment again, and the British government, and America. If you add all these to the mix, then if you were ever going to do something dodgy to Diana, that's the time you would do it. She'd become trouble, as she used to say to me. I'm trouble to them. I won't go away. I won't go quietly.
She won't go quietly. That's the problem. I'll fight till the end.
Presidents have been killed for mess.
Keith Allen there, ending that little excerpt from Unlawful Killing. That's Keith's film, financed by Dodi Fayed, Mohammed Al-Fayed, sorry, about the killing of his son, Dodi Al-Fayed, and also Princess Diana. Now, some people call it the secret government of the NATO countries. The Bilderberg Group certainly seems to have an uncanny knack of picking top politicians in Europe and the United States just before they rise to power. For example, they didn't like former Labour leader John Smith, but they did like the man who rose to become Prime Minister and war criminal, Tony Blair. Now, Martin Summers, we've had quite a lot of we did quite a lot of coverage of this last week, but have you noticed anything that's come out in as part of that coverage which tells you anything about what the Bilderbergers are about and what plans they've got for the NATO country's future?
Well, there's been a very big troop movements in the Mediterranean this week. The US Sixth Fleet and various other fleets are moving into place basically to threaten the Arab countries. I'm sure that was what was discussed at Bilderberg, or one of the things.
Now, there are particular Arab countries that it seems that... Is it Syria and Lebanon? That's what I was reading, anyway. Yeah. I think this was on globalresearch.ca, I read that.
Yeah.
Now, what about the fact that we had for the first time ever, two Chinese delegates?
I think that's significant, because that's the first time the Chinese have ever been invited. I think the Chinese have been invited because they gave an ultimatum to the Americans about 10 days ago after the so-called killing of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, which nobody in Pakistan believes, by the way. Whatever did or did not happen, nobody in Pakistan believes it. The Chinese gave a public ultimatum to the Americans for the first time since World War II, and they said, if you go into Pakistan again without discussing it with the Pakistani government and with the Pakistani military, you won't be taking on the Pakistanis, you'll be taking us on, Chinese People's Liberation Army. And I understand one of the Chinese that was there was an economics person and the other person was a military person, so they've probably been invited to try and mollify them a bit.
The other big thing there was lots and lots of people to do with the internet and cyber security. So we're talking about the boss of LinkedIn.com, the boss of Amazon.com, the boss of Facebook, the boss of Google, alongside the head of cyber warfare for the National Security Agency, which is the American government's main intelligence gathering, a bit like our GCHQ.
Yes, I think it's been flagged up that cyber warfare is the new sliced bread, and we've all got to take notice of cyber warfare. But we've been uncovering, and you've been uncovering, Tony, aspects of false blogging going on, like this guy who's pretending to be a gay activist in Damascus, and it turns out he lives in Edinburgh, and he's not a woman, let alone a gay woman. there is disinformation out there. The modern world is full of information, but it's also full of disinformation. And intelligence agencies are not just about pulling the wool over people's eyes by keeping secrets. They also deliberately misinform. So we're not being told about a lot of things that are going on, and other things that aren't, that haven't happened, we're being told as if they were happening. It's a kind of virtual reality, like the Matrix is being created, where we've got to question everything we're being told by everybody.
Now, I mean, I've been talking about this Bilderberg meeting as a kind of secret government in the NATO countries. Do you think that's exaggerating?
No, I think that's exactly right. That's precisely what they are. But the fact that they've invited the Chinese shows that that's not a hard and fast rule. One wonders which meetings the Chinese were invited into and which ones they were told that they couldn't go to. No doubt a lot of decisions were made in back rooms and bars without anybody else present. I mean, that's, you know, that's, that seems to be what Bilderberg's about. Although I don't think they make the decisions at Bilderberg. I think the decisions are made elsewhere, and these people are called together, like now, as they do in the US Marines, say, come on, listen up, this is what we're doing. And they want feedback on what's already been planned. They're just making sure that all of the people are safe, in the loop, what have you. I think they do sometimes invite people they're not entirely happy with, but then they don't get invited back.
Yeah, they do seem to have a bit of a disdain for elected politicians, even though they invite them along. And one of the things that came out for the first time this year was that George Osborne is there with his full Treasury team in an official capacity. Up until now, I mean, we're talking about the sort of 60 years or so of the history of this organisation, they have always said that, that everybody who attends that group attends it in a private capacity. So this is a big change.
It is, and in actual fact, it was always a bit of a cover-up anyway. In actual fact, these people were representing the organisation which they headed up, whatever was being said on their website. And of course, they only created a website a few years ago to respond to your website. They didn't used to have one. They didn't bother to tell anybody what they were doing at all. Now they feel as if they've got to come out and say something. What I'd like to hear from George Osborne in his speech at the Mansion House yesterday, if he took Treasury officials with him to this meeting, I want to see the minutes. I want to see the minutes of those meetings. Or if not me, somebody else should have access to those minutes. Why haven't we got them? Well, he's a public employee, so are the Treasury officials. They're not to go to meetings and have secret discussions where there are no minutes. Absolutely not.
One of the reasons I say they show quite a lot of disdain is not just to do with the theory, it's also in practical terms as well, because an Italian member of the European Parliament, Mario Borghesio, was given a bloody nose on Thursday as he attempted to sneak into the secretive Bilderberg conference in St Moritz. Borghesio, who is a right-wing Italian, from the right-wing Italian party Lega Nord, was reportedly with another Italian as he attempted to infiltrate the luxury Servetta House Hotel in Switzerland where the conference was taking place. Borghesio was blocked by guards from security firm Securitas, who then called in the Swiss police. After having their identities checked, the two Italians were told they could not enter the building. But according to the Italian news agency ANSA, Borghesio's nose was bloodied or broken during the altercation with security guards. He told the agency he intends to press charges. Swiss police spokesperson Thomas Hobi said, "We don't comment on the work of private security firms." So that was the only information that the journalists in the Spanish-speaking English language newspaper got from the police there. And also, for tactical reasons, the police did not want to give any more information on the objects, but it is understood that they are. In a separate incident, the two Swiss men were detained near the conference because of several suspicious items were found in their car. Hobi said that for tactical reasons, the police did not want to give any more information on the objects, but it is understood they initially suspected explosives. A security cordon was set up around the car while forensic specialists investigated these objects, and the items in the car were eventually judged to be harmless. Apparently it was a tube of Pringles. So what does this tell us if this MEP is actually being beaten up, to a certain extent anyway, trying to get into this meeting, about whether it's a private meeting or whether it really is actually secret?
Well, I think what the MEP did there was draw attention to the fact that it took place, and I'm sure he'll be nursing his bloody nose, but he'll have achieved his goal. I think it's quite interesting that the Lega du Nord are, in fact, from my point of view, a quasi-fascist party, and they're suspicious about these kind of shindigs of the great and the good. I'm a left-winger, and I'm suspicious about these shindigs of the great and the good. Basically, they seem to be stitching things up. Both Peter Mandelson and George Osborne were both there, and as we all know, they are chums, even though one is supposedly Labour and one is supposedly Conservative. And this, of course, does raise questions in the minds of ordinary people. Well, what are you cooking up in there? You know, this is what you're supposedly opponents politically, but you're all at the same meeting and you're all then coming out singing from the same hymn sheet. What's going on here? And I think there's a legitimate question to be asked there.
Well, it's not just Mandelson, is it? It's also Ed Balls. A couple of years ago, he decided to... I think there is a certain vanity in politicians that go to these meetings. They're thinking to themselves, actually, I do want to rub shoulders with these incredibly rich and powerful people, and I'm sure no one's going to really mind. But actually, the voters do mind.
Well, if you were invited to go and you turn it down, you may be putting yourself in a great deal of difficulty. And I understand why politicians go. I mean, John Smith went... To Bilderberg, but he was basically telling them things they didn't want to hear, and so he wasn't invited back.
He died during the year after.
Yes, he did, and just before he died, he spoke to the Socialist International in Geneva, in Switzerland. It's quoted in my book, where he said...
What's the title of your book?
The title of my book is Market Failure, Eastern Europe's Economic Miracle, which is ironic, and it's written by myself and my colleague Laszlo Andor of Budapest University, now of the European Bank.
Okay, so what did John Smith, the former Labour leader,
say? Well, he said basically the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have outlived their usefulness and they'll have to be abolished. That went down like a lead balloon, and of course they're still there making mess.
And isn't this something slightly similar to what Dominic Strauss-Kahn, the head of the IMF, was saying recently?
Dominic Strauss-Kahn is probably a little bit better than Lipsky, who's taken over from him, but I'm afraid all of these people sing ultimately from the same hymn sheet. They all believe in free markets, so-called free markets, which are bailed out by the taxpayer. They've got an elite agenda which looks after the wealthy classes. So you've got to remember, we have elections in this country and other countries, but the electorate that the politicians really have to satisfy are the big money people, and what ordinary people want or don't want is very much a second fiddle. That has got to change.
Well, the BBC, would they comment on the Bilderberg conference? You would expect so, since the richest and most powerful chief executives, bankers, politicians, finance ministers and royalty, it's the only time of the year that these lot all get together. You would expect them to write about it, but they actually wrote a piece which was really rather poking fun at anyone that might think that there should be more coverage on the BBC. But funnily enough, we found out the BBC were at the Bilderberg conference last weekend, but only in the form of Marcus Agius, who's senior non-executive director on the BBC's executive board. He's also chairman of Barclays and extremely well connected. And there are some pictures taken by Charlie Skelton of him queuing to get on a private jet home. So he must be very well connected. I must also say about this, well, you don't have to say anything, but I will. Charlie Skelton's coverage for the Guardian blog has been absolutely exemplary and really humorous. I mean, some of the best coverage I've ever seen of one of these conferences. Also doing a review of the various handbags held by the ladies and man bags carried by the men of all different sorts. So can you just sum up here, Martin, really? Explain to us really what kind of economic power groups like this have, because you do have the royalty, you do have the chief executives of the biggest corporations. We're also talking about a smattering of military cyber warfare people, as well as the banking elites and the top bankers. We're talking about the IMF, the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, all the really big banks, and plus you've got a load of finance ministers and former prime ministers in there too.
Well, that's right. I mean, as I've said before, I see Bilderberg traditionally as a kind of like a gypsy horse fair, where the financial elites just buy and sell the politicians. They look at their fetlocks, they look at their teeth, and decide whether they want to bet on them. I think what's becoming... At one stage, you could say, if all these private sector people want to get together and have a private meeting, there's not a lot anybody can do about it. But then the politicians are our representatives, and they really shouldn't be in these meetings without telling us what's going on. That's completely wrong. Especially now we've bailed out the private banks. So, as I said before, we give the banks money. They then use this money to buy our politicians. That's our money they're using to buy our politicians to do their will. And ultimately, this is a question of power. Power. And the military people are there because, as Mao Zedong rightly said, he didn't say many right things, but this was right, power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Ultimately, we're talking about wars. That's what they're plotting away at doing. They're the military-industrial complex and the banks, and they're a menace to humanity.
Well, just to sort of sum up Charlie's stuff, it's all on the Guardian website. If you go to the Builder blog, find your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google, who were represented by their chief executive at this Bilderberg conference, and find a search engine and plug in a Builder blog and Charlie Skelton, you'll find all Charlie's wonderful coverage of that conference. He's also encouraging people to go along to next year's meeting by emailing him. He's saying also that the anonymity seems to be for the Bilderbergers and not for the public, because when everybody turned up, there was no checking of passports or anything like that. Anyhow, what the mainstream press have failed to do, says Charlie Skelton, the alternative media are simply getting on and doing. In the absence of an adequate press centre, people formed their own. In the weird journalistic vacuum of the conference, people are news gathering and sharing their information, sending out bulletins to the world. It's properly inspiring, and it's only going to get bigger. If you're simply looking to meet switched on, clued up people, come to Bilderberg 2012, wherever it may be, in Europe or North America. If you want to help, observe, tweet, photograph, give legal advice, learn, share, chat, talk geopolitics, attend meetings, or just sip beer and watch the spectacle unfold, then come. Spectacle of Bilderberg is reason enough to turn up, but the people, that's where the real value is. He's asking people to email him at bilderbergmeetings@yahoo.com. That's bilderbergmeetings@yahoo.com. And come along to the summit of a lifetime.
Can I just say that he was also live on our show last week, was he not, Tony? And we've done our bit to expose Bilderberg, and they can find our previous material at www.thisweek.org.
Thisweek.org.uk.
Thank you very much
for last week's show.
Yeah.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, a couple of weeks ago was the end of a rather good documentary series on BBC, just after criticising them for not covering the Bilderberg conference properly. We're now going to compliment them because Adam Curtis brought up in the first of the episodes of his documentary series, All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, he brought up the character of Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand, Martin, who was Ayn Rand, and why was she so influential? Because even though many of us have never heard of her, apparently lots and lots of chief executives, particularly in the technological industries in the United States and the military, love her.
Well, I mean, people need to, it's still on iPlayer, I believe, Machines of Love and Grace. The first episode covers Ayn Rand quite extensively. I mean, I'm not a great expert on Ayn Rand. She wrote a series of novels which were very much to the liking of right-wing free marketeers in the United States, basically because she said that selfishness is good and people should be selfish, and by being selfish, the best outcomes for society will emerge. Seems pretty silly to me. I mean, my dad taught me not to think like that when I was three, but apparently Alan Greenspan and all these top people, all these super entrepreneurs, they all thought, yes, yes, selfishness, what a great idea, I don't have to care about anybody. What? And she told them what they wanted to hear, and she was jolly popular for telling them what they wanted to hear.
So do you think Ayn Rand is responsible for the world being in a bit of a mess?
No, I think that's where I did part company with Adam Curtis. He's very good at showing how silly ideas take root at an elite level.
Bad ideas.
But of course the real force here isn't her ideas. The real force is the selfishness itself. These people want to hear from somebody that selfishness is good. That is because they are selfish. And the real problem is their selfishness, not their silly ideas.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Ayn Rand now. Give her a fair chance, a fair crack of the whip against Martin and my criticism. And here she is back in 1959 being interviewed by CBS's Mike Wallace.
Down through history, various political and philosophical movements have sprung up, but most of them have died. Some, however, like democracy or communism, take hold and affect the entire world. Here in the United States, perhaps the most challenging and unusual new philosophy has been forged by a novelist, Ayn Rand. Ms. Rand's point of view is still comparatively unknown in America, but if it ever did take hold, it would revolutionize our lives. And Ayn, to begin with, I wonder if I can ask you to capsulize. I know this is difficult. Can I ask you to capsulize your philosophy? What is Randism?
First of all, I do not call it Randism, and I don't like that name. Call it objectivism.
All right.
Meaning a philosophy based on objective reality. Now, let me explain it as briefly as I can. First, my philosophy is based on the concept that reality exists as an objective absolute, that man's mind, reason, is his means of perceiving it, and that man needs a rational morality. I am primarily the creator of a new code of morality, which has so far been believed impossible, namely, a morality not based on faith.
On faith.
Not on faith, not on arbitrary whim, not on emotion, not on arbitrary edict, mystical or social, but on reason, a morality which can be proved by means of logic, which can be demonstrated to be true and necessary.
All right. All right.
Now, may I define what my morality is?
All right.
Because this is merely an introduction. My morality is based on man's life as a standard of value. And since man's mind is his basic means of survival, I hold that if man wants to live on Earth and to live as a human being, he has to hold reason as an absolute, by which I mean that he has to hold reason as his only guide to action, and that he must live by the independent judgment of his own mind, that his highest moral purpose is the achievement of his own happiness, and that he must not force other people nor accept their right to force him, that each man must live as an end in himself and follow his own rational self-interest.
May I interrupt now?
You may.
Because you put this philosophy to work in your novel Atlas Shrugged.
That's right.
You demonstrate it in human terms in your novel Atlas Shrugged. And let me start by quoting from a review of this novel, Atlas Shrugged, that appeared in Newsweek. It said that you are out to destroy almost every edifice in the contemporary American way of life, our Judeo-Christian religion, our modified government-regulated capitalism, our rule by the majority will. Other reviews have said that you scorn churches and the concept of God. Are these accurate criticisms?
Yes. I agree with the facts, but not the estimate of this criticism. Namely, if I am challenging the base of all these institutions, I'm challenging the moral code of altruism, the precept that man's moral duty is to live for others, that man must sacrifice himself to others, which is the present-day morality.
What do you mean by sacrifice himself for others? This, now we're getting to the point.
One moment. Since I'm challenging the base, I necessarily would challenge the institutions you name, which are a result of that morality.
All right.
And now what is self-sacrifice?
Yes, what is self-sacrifice? You say that you do not like the altruism by which we live. You like a certain kind of Ayn Randist selfishness.
I would say that I don't like is too weak a word. I consider it evil. And self-sacrifice is the precept that man needs to serve others in order to justify his existence, that his moral duty is to serve others. That is what most people believe today.
Well, yes, we're taught to feel concerned for our fellow man, to feel responsible for his welfare, to feel that we are, as religious people might put it, children under God and responsible one for the other. Now, why do you rebel? What's wrong with this philosophy?
But that is what, in fact, makes man a sacrificial animal. That man must work for others, concern himself with others, or be responsible for them. That is the role of a sacrificial object. I say that man is entitled to his own happiness and that he must achieve it himself, but that he cannot demand that others give up their lives to make him happy. Nor should he wish to sacrifice himself for the happiness of others. I hold that man should have self-esteem.
And cannot man have self-esteem if he loves his fellow man? What's wrong with loving your fellow man? Christ, every important moral leader in man's history, has taught us that we should love one another. Why, then, is this kind of love, in your mind, immoral?
It is immoral if it is a love placed above oneself. It is more than immoral, it's impossible. Because when you are asked to love everybody indiscriminately, that is, to love people without any standard, to love them regardless of the fact of whether they have any value or virtue, you are asked to love nobody.
But in a sense, in your book, you talk about love as if it were a business deal of some kind. Isn't the essence of love that it is above above self-interest?
Well, let me make it concrete for you. What would it mean to have love above self-interest? It would mean, for instance, that a husband would tell his wife, if he were moral, according to the conventional morality, that I am marrying you just for your own sake. I have no personal interest in it, but I am so unselfish that I am marrying you only for your own good.
Well, should husbands and wives tally up?
Would any woman like that?
Should husbands and wives tally up at the end of the day and say, well, now, wait a minute, I love her if she's done enough for me today, or she loves me if I have properly performed my functions?
No, you misunderstood me. That is not how love should be treated. I agree with you that it should be treated like a business deal, but every business has to have its own terms and its own kind of currency. And in love, the currency is virtue. You love people not for what you do for them or what they do for you. You love them for the values, the virtues which they have achieved in their own character. You don't love causelessly. You don't love everybody indiscriminately. You love only those who deserve it.
And then if a man is weak or a woman is weak, then he is beyond love?
He certainly does not deserve it. He certainly is beyond. He can always correct it. Man has free will. If a man wants love, he should correct his weaknesses or his flaws, and he may deserve it. But he cannot expect the unearned, neither in love nor in money, in matter nor spirit.
You have lived in our world, and you recognize the fallibility of human beings. There are very few of us, then, in this world, by your standards, who are worthy of love.
Unfortunately, yes, very few. But it is open to everybody to make themselves worthy of it, and that is all that my morality offers them.
If they will...
way to make themselves worthy of love, although that's not the primary motive.
That was a trip way back to 1959, and that was Mike Wallace there interviewing Ayn Rand. Martin, it's a bit worrying, isn't it, to think of this kind of idea of love as a kind of business deal and a commodity. But do you really think that Rand had as much influence as Adam Curtis was saying? Certainly there were a lot of people interviewed as part of that documentary, big business people in the United States, particularly technology people, who were absolutely devoted to her.
Yes, and also Alan Greenspan, who presided over the Federal Reserve during the bubble and the crash. He was a very close friend of Ayn Rand's. Fascinatingly enough, what Adam Curtis brings out in the film is that Ayn Rand then told the husband of a friend of hers that it was logical that he should leave his wife and come and live with her, which he did. And the wife was complacent at the time, and she was asked in the film, that's altruism. She said, yes, that's a paradox, isn't it? Now, what I find extraordinary is these rather mundane ideas of personal selfishness as the road to salvation have been treated by very serious people in the United States at the top level in business and government as if they're serious ideas. I mean, Ayn Rand, to me, she's not really a serious thinker, but many of her ideas are basically copies of ideas of Friedrich Nietzsche, who was a serious philosopher in the 19th century. But Nietzsche would have laughed at the simplicity of the way she's formulated those ideas. He saw the Superman or the cleverer people as beyond wanting to dominate others, beyond personal selfishness, whereas hers is just it's the same old boring bourgeois creed of I'm all right, Jack, pull up the ladder, but it's been given a hugely kind of grandiose sort of working, and all these very, very bright, brainy people bought into it because they were basically selfish, and she told them what they wanted to hear.
Going back to the Bilderbergers for a moment, David Rockefeller is part of the Rockefeller family, that famously said years ago, don't let good fellowship get the least hold of you. All great men have been brought down by good fellowship.
Well, all I can say to that is I think of great men like Steve Biko, who gave his life for his country, died in a prison. They kill him in a prison. Those are the people I hold up. As Jesus said, greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. That's what I admire. That's what I like to see in people. I don't like to see all this justification for personal selfishness. It's pathetic.
Okay, it's coming up towards 7 o'clock, but before that, let's have some music. Blue Oyster Cult, Don't Fear the Reaper, Don't Fear in brackets. That must have been from, was it late 70s, early 80s sometime. Anyway, before we wrap up, just a couple of reminders. First of all, we were talking earlier on about the Architects and Engineers for 9/11truth.org. That is the talk going on next Tuesday, 21st of June, 7:30 p.m. at Colston Hall in Colston Street. Tickets £6 or £4. And the talk is by Richard Gage. He's from the AIA, American Architects Association of some sort. And he's a 23-year architect and internationally acclaimed speaker. He's doing a tour right round the UK and Ireland, and he's coming to Bristol next Tuesday evening, 7:30 at Colston Hall. Also, tomorrow, Bristol and District's Anti-Cuts Alliance at midday, also at the Colston Hall, have a five-hour conference all about the cuts. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next is the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Conservative Member of Parliament for North East Somerset, Jacob Rees-Mogg, and, of course, to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's five-point economic recovery plan, a report on mobile phone masts and wireless safety, evidence of Masonic corruption in the police, an extended interview with managing editor of BBC Radio Bristol, Tim Pemberton, an investigation into leadership charity, Common Purpose, as well as our fifth anniversary look at the 7/7 London bombings of 2005 from last year. And I imagine in July, beginning of July, a couple of weeks' time, we should be looking at that one again. So just go to thisweek.org.uk and click on the link to our archives. A podcast of this show is usually online by midnight after broadcast. Well, that's enough talk for tonight, because Friday night is music night here on BCFM. We have the UFO show up next. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We have about 60 million people in Britain and 60 million acres of land. So, whilst it might seem that there's not enough resources to go around, that's only because banks and big business have hijacked far more land than their fair share. All we have to do is make sure that 60 million acres is shared out fairly and with modern technology, not controlled by a power elite like the Bilderbergs, for example. We can all live happily together. Do please join us for Friday drive time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
You are listening on BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a